Hello again. That was planned. It's a little bit fake, but I'll receive it. Hey, thanks for coming to church today. And I'm grateful to those of you who are joining us online. And I assume you hooted when you saw me come on screen. This morning, we continue a series we're calling Get a Life, because we're talking about the new life we can live in Jesus. Each week we're unpacking a new verse or a new phrase in Colossians chapter 3 verses 1 through 17 in which the Apostle Paul describes the life that could be ours. We're talking about a life of grace and gratitude and peace and patience, a life that's free of sin and shame and overflowing with hope and wholeness. Now before we return to Paul's letter, why don't we take a moment, invite God to speak to us. Would you join your hearts with me? Lord, as we turn to the scriptures to study a subject of surprising significance, Lord, I pray you open our eyes to see the gravity of this topic, but also the grace you offer us, not just to forgive us, but to change us, to transform us, to make us into the people you've called us to be. Lord, give us the faith to reach for your help today. We pray this in the powerful and trustworthy name of King Jesus. Amen. In his book, Scorn, the subtitle being the wittiest and wickedest insults in human history, Matthew Paris, columnist for the Times in London, contends there is no pleasure like a perfectly turned put down. His work catalogs some of the sharpest zingers recorded in time, from ancient Roman graffiti to the battlefields of Twitter. Paris draws on bile from the arenas of literature, politics, and entertainment to argue abuse can be an art form. For example, Albert Einstein once observed, "Only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the former." The Duke of Windsor, Edward VIII, opined, "The thing that impresses me most about America is the way parents obey their children." When asked, "What do you think of Western civilization?" Mahatma Gandhi quipped, "I think it would be a good idea." Founding Father John Adams confessed, "In my many years, I've come to a conclusion that one useless man is a shame, two is a law firm, and three or more is a Congress." Lincoln once remarked about a political opponent, "He can compress the most words into the smallest idea of any man I ever met." After publishing her first book, actress Ilka Chase was asked by a catty colleague, "I enjoyed reading your book. Who wrote it for you?" Chase retorted, "Darling, I'm so glad you liked it. Who read it to you?" At the passing of an acquaintance, the master of wit, Mark Twain, quipped, "I didn't attend the funeral, but I sent a nice letter saying I approved of it." Perhaps the best wielder of the verbal sledgehammer in the last century was Winston Churchill, who jibed, "He has all the virtues I dislike and none of the vices I admire." Churchill was once asked by a fellow parliamentarian, "Mr. Churchill, must you fall asleep when I'm speaking?" The statesman rejoined, "No, it's purely voluntary." Churchill's savage instincts may be best exhibited by an exchange he had with a disapproving woman who zinged, "If I were your wife, I'd poison your tea." Churchill bit back, "If you were my wife, I'd drink it." I believe that's what the kids today call a sick burn. Now, as I prepared for this weekend's message, I found no shortage of historic and contemporary examples of such invectives. How about this one? "I have neither the time nor the crayons to explain this to you." Here's another. "You are the reason why shampoo has instructions." Now, they're funny, unless they're not funny. Right? I think of the comedic legends Steve Martin and Martin Short. I love watching these guys in interviews as they take one another down a peg or two. They're good at it. And now it's clear the banter between them is merely a gentle ribbing between friends. It's all in good fun and no harm is intended nor received. They obviously have a prearranged understanding that their decades-long repartee is a way that they show love to one another. But may I make an observation? You and I usually don't have that excuse. A husband berates his wife who can do nothing right. A perfectionist parent belittles a child stripping away her self-esteem. A friend talks to another friend about another friend's messy house or messy life without realizing she pocket-dialed the friend who no longer wants to be her friend and no longer feels like she has friends. I think we can all agree, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words hurt really bad too. That's why Paul writes to a community he loves, "Now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips." Now, a few weeks back, my friend and colleague Kelly worked through the first two characteristics that Paul says we need to shed. Today, we're going to tackle the last three. Paul says we need to take off malice, slander, and filthy language. The verb he uses sometimes conveys the removal of clothing. Think of working in the yard for 8 hours on a hot, humid August day in Houston. Then picture yourself peeling off each of your nasty, sweaty articles of clothing one by one so you can get cleaned up. That's the picture Paul paints. The word malice involves mean-spirited dialogue or discourse. Slander in Greek, it's refers to defamatory speech, true or exaggerated, that denigrates or defames a person, whether it's behind their back or in front of their face. Filthy language literally is translated shameful words. It's a rare word in Greek. It's only used here in the New Testament. It may refer to obscene language in general, but it definitely refers particularly to vulgar language that's directed at others. You see, Paul's admonition in Colossians 3:8 challenges us to pay close attention to how we talk to and how we talk about one another. How are we doing with that? How often did you make a derogatory comment about an incompetent coworker this week? What words did you choose when you griped about how your sister is raising her kids or taking care of her body? Look, talking badly about people has become so common we don't even notice we do it anymore. Especially when we slander people from a distance. Consider how we talk about celebrities or athletes or politicians. Sure, you may disagree with his views on abortion or immigration, but contrasting your personal beliefs with theirs does not require character assassination. What makes it any different that they're in the public eye? Does their celebrity status somehow make it acceptable for followers of Jesus to degrade them with our words? Yet we do. Just last week, I'm on the phone with my wife, and I was conveying the content of a conversation I had earlier in the day. But I could tell she was a little shaken by something I said about somebody. I don't recall exactly what I expressed. I may or may not have said the person I was talking to was dumber than a rake, which I was certain was both amusing and accurate, by the way. But Suzanne wasn't amused, so I do a little fishing. I ask, "What are you thinking?" She says, "Troy, you've been talking like that more lately." And she says, "I wonder what that says about what's happening in your soul." See, in the moment, my wife was reminding me of a phrase I use often but clearly do not apply to my life. What's in you comes out of you. writes is, Paul casts a vision for the new life we can live. He knows, on the one hand, our words wound. On the other hand, our words reveal. First, consider how our words wound. How they pierce the people around us as we cut ourselves on the blade we wield. Consider the power of the tongue. Proverbs 18:21. The tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Friends, the tongue is a potent force in the world. With it, teachers instruct their students. Activists inspire their volunteers. With the tongue, a mom soothes a crying infant. A friend comforts a grieving loved one. A groom declares his vows to his bride. Some of our best work as human gets done by the tongue. But that same tongue is the source of some of our greatest evil. That same tongue makes life miserable. The book of Proverbs has a lot to say about the consequences of careless speech. Proverbs 12, verse 13, evildoers are trapped by their sinful talk, and so the innocent escape trouble. Proverbs 18, 6, the lips of fools bring them strife, and their mouths invite a beating. Verse 7, the mouths of fools are their undoing, and their lips are a snare to their very lives. Friends, think how much unnecessary drama we bring into our lives because of our words. Worse still, think how much drama we bring into the lives of our loved ones. The same tongue used to build up is the same tongue used to tear down. But as we recognize our words wound, we must also acknowledge our words reveal. The words that escape our lips do not originate in our mouths. They well up from within our souls. You may know the old expression, what's down in the well comes up in the bucket. Well, it's confirmed by the clear teaching of Jesus in Luke 6:45, for out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Look, I often remind you, what's in you sloshes out of you when people bump into you. So what's in you? Is it love, joy, peace, and patience, or anger, irritation, criticism, and contempt? See, when Jesus and Paul and others challenge us to focus inward, when they direct our gaze from our outsides to our insides, they don't want to humiliate us, they want to heal us. By watching what comes out of our mouths, we see what's buried deep in our souls. The Apostle James warns his readers about their words. In James 1:26, he says, those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. Throughout his letter, James says real faith works. James believes if we claim to know God, but God's character is not being formed in us, then there's something wrong with our faith. James cautions his reader again, continuing his warning on words in chapter 3 and verse 2. He says, anyone who is never at fault and what they say is perfect, able to keep their whole body in check. Whoa, that sounds like hyperbole. But I should say, James's word perfect is the Greek word teleos. Now, teleos can be translated perfect, but it also means complete. It means mature. James doesn't mean that the individual who watches her mouth is free of all sin. He means the person is fully orbed, mature and complete. He's saying if a person can tame the tongue, the rest of life is a cakewalk. That verb keep in check is literally translated bridle, which sets up his illustration in verse 3. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Here, James hands us the first of three analogies that illustrate the power of the tongue. Do I have any equestrians in the room? Okay. Even if you don't know how to ride, you may know that a bit is a small piece of metal placed in the mouth of a horse. It's connected to the reins to give the rider control of the animal. A horse is a powerful creature. The average horse can lift a weight that would strain the strongest man alive. The average horse weighs half a ton.
If you place a tiny sliver of metal in its mouth, you can put an 80-pound child on its back. And the child, if she knows what she's doing, can control the horse's movements. Just like the bit, the tongue is deceptively powerful. The second analogy shows up in verse 4. Or take ships as an example. Although they are large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Now here he's using a different picture to make the same point. He makes the plain contrast between the enormous ship, the cruel winds, and the tiny little rudder. Likewise, he says, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Well, the tongue actually has a lot to brag about. It dominates the less influential parts of the body. He continues, verse 5, consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. Few disasters were more feared in the ancient world than fire. Think about it. They had no plumbing, no sprinkler systems, no fire hydrants, no State Farm. A small kitchen fire, which today could easily be doused by a fire extinguisher, meant massive destruction in the time of James. It only takes a spark. Consider the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. It burned for 3 days, killing hundreds of people, destroying several square miles of Chicago. It stands on the books as one of the largest disasters in the United States during the 19th century. But on that same day, 400 miles to the north, a prairie fire broke out in Peshtigo, Wisconsin, consuming 1.5 million acres of land, an area twice the size of Rhode Island. No one knows for certain how many people died. Population records were destroyed, but it's estimated that 1,200 to 2,500 lives were lost that day. The Peshtigo fire remains the worst fire in U.S. history. It only takes a spark. James says, the tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. The Apostle Paul, or the Apostle James, points to one of the greatest threats of his day to paint the picture of the destructive power of our words. So let's pull this into our lives today. Some of us are highly trained assassins with the English language. Some of us have such a way with words, we can win any argument, we can put anyone in their place. Our sarcasm is cunning and biting. We're so honest with our words. We tell people just what we think of them, their ideas, their behavior, their appearance. Now, it's not that honesty itself is bad, but our current brand of honesty is leaving in its wake broken relationships, broken hearts, broken dreams. Our words are like a scorching fire. They burn everyone they touch, and it's usually the people closest to us who get burned the worst. James says the tongue corrupts the whole body. Literally in Greek, it stains the whole person. Now that's a vivid image. Consider, James's first reader didn't have spray and wash. They didn't have Tide sticks. Any of you use a Tide stick? I carry one of these in my bag everywhere I go. I use it on strangers. But they didn't have Tide sticks in James's day. If a garment got stained, the garment got ruined. James says the tongue can do the same to you. It can stain your reputation. It can stain your soul. He says it corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire. Look at this. How you use your tongue will shape your destiny. Did you hear that? Think about it. Some of you are still paying the price for words you spoke years ago. But it's not just your destiny that's being shaped. Your words are leaving a mark on the people around you. Parents, grandparents, teachers, your words influence the future of the children in your life. Are you making them feel hopeful or helpless? Are you giving them confidence or complex? James says the tongue, when used for evil, corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. Look where the tongue gets its destructive power. The Greek word he uses for hell is Gehenna, but it stems from two Hebrew words, Gaia Hinnom. Located just outside of Jerusalem, this valley was infamous in the Old Testament for being the place where pagans sacrificed children to the god Molech. Later, when the Babylonians invaded Judah, they tossed the bodies of slain Jews into this valley, after which it was dubbed the Valley of Slaughter. By the first century, it was used as a dump where trash was burned. They said the fires never go out in Gaia Hinnom. Well, you can see why in James's day, Jews considered it an apt illustration for the fires of hell. And James says, that's the source of your tongue's destructive power. Now, why does James use such extreme language? Because he doesn't want us to minimize, rationalize, or excuse the hellish consequences of our words. He isn't done yet. Let's momentarily jump ahead to verse 9. With the tongue, he says, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings, watch this, who have been made in God's likeness. He's pointing back to the book of Genesis. James says, you may come to church and sing the songs with God's people, but leave the building only to destroy people with the same tongue. And you can see the theology embedded in his words. He reminds us that the men and women we curse, the men and women we tear down, are men and women who have been made in God's image. James suggests our conversation with one another is an opportunity to praise God or blaspheme God. He reminds you, your neighbor, your nephew, the aggravating and aggravated people around you, they're all people created in the very likeness of God. In spite of their flaws, in spite of their incompetence, at their core, they reflect God's image. And how we speak to them has deep theological ramifications. Now that's true of everybody, except for the guy I was talking about to Suzanne. See, last week I found the one bloke in human history who was not created in God's image. Oh, wait. James remarks, verse 10, out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Then James asks, can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. Can both sweet water and bitter water flow from the same spring? The expected answer to his rhetorical question is, absolutely not. So how then do we explain the poison that drips from our lips every day? What's his point? I'll explain it with another analogy. We take a thermometer and place it under our tongue to check our physical temperature. Well, the tongue serves a similar purpose in gauging our spiritual temperature. James says, if your tongue destroys, perhaps you should question what's really going on in your soul. What selfishness, what evil, what darkness lurks at your center? Jesus said it this way in Matthew 15:18. The things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them. We have a lot of medical professionals in the room, but hey, here's something they didn't teach you in med school. The tongue bone's connected to the heart bone. What's in you comes out of you. So what's in you? Back up to verse 7. He says all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind. Think about it. We train animals to do remarkable things. Parrots can speak. Dogs can detect illicit substances. James says all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. Oh, let this sink in. Verse 8 conveys hopelessness. No one can tame the tongue. James says it's a restless evil. That means it's uncontrollable and unpredictable. Like a viper, it can strike anyone at any time. Through sheer discipline of the will, you may be able to curb some of the most serious effects of your speech. But James says, for the most part, it's a lost cause. No human can tame their tongue. You don't have a prayer. Or maybe that's all you have. What if you could tap into God's power to tame the tongue? Friends, what if in real time, as your emotions begin to swell, as your child talks back, as your roommate blames you, you prayed this prayer: set a guard over my mouth, Lord. Keep watch over the door of my lips. This prayer is from Psalm 141, verse 3. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of great passages in the Bible. Some passages communicate truth. Some passages offer comfort. This passage hands us a solution. This passage suggests a prayer we can pray to rein in our unruly tongue. It's a simple prayer, but if you pray it, it's likely to revolutionize the way you interact with everyone around you. Set a guard over my mouth, Lord. Keep watch over the door of my lips. It's a poetic request for God to put an armed guard at the gate of your mouth so nothing will escape your lips and go wild. James says, no human being can tame the tongue. But he didn't say it was beyond God. Now, I want to return to the book of Proverbs. Because the sages who collected these wise sayings offer tried and tested insight on how to talk to and about others. For example, the sages had a few things to say about gossip. Proverbs 16:28, a perverse person stirs up conflict. And a gossip separates close friends. Think about it. How many relationships have been obliterated by gossip? How many reputations ruined? Think of a time when you've been a victim. Think of a time when someone has talked about you behind your back. They talked about your flaws, your mistakes, your shortcomings, whether true or false. How'd you feel? Did you feel loved? Accepted? How did it affect your sense of self-worth? But friends, for some reason, even though we all know what it's like to experience it, we also love being on the receiving end of it. There's nothing quite like a juicy bit of gossip. Proverbs 18:8 tells us why. The words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to the inmost parts. I love that language, choice morsels. In its original context, it probably had to do with meat. In the ancient world, meat wasn't served at every meal of the commoner. It was a treat to be cherished. This will come as a shock to you. But when I think of the word morsel, I think of chocolate chips. I think of homemade chocolate chip cookies. And my fellow connoisseurs in the room will concur, the set central to a good chocolate chip cookie are high quality ingredients. You want to use real butter. And friends, you most certainly want to use high-quality chocolate chips, preferably semi-sweet. Think of a freshly baked chocolate chip cookie, one when torn asunder has a string of chocolate blessing holding the two parts together. As Tim Hawkins says, it's like eating a baby angel. But the same is true of gossip. It's so interesting, so tasty, so addicting. Why? It's because gossip brings others down and raises me up. I feel better about myself if everyone else has problems. But gossip is a serious sin in the eyes of God. Gossip is on a list in Romans chapter 1 that places gossipers alongside liars, murderers, and God haters. Why do you think God is so serious about gossip? I think it's because of the damage it does. Look, I've seen not just lies, but whole churches destroyed by this behavior. No love, no authenticity, no acceptance can exist in an environment where gossip is tolerated. But the whole idea of God's kingdom gets short-circuited. And friends, I believe the evil one is especially gifted at crafting elaborate schemes of he said, she said to destroy relationships. And God doesn't want us to be a part of it. Robertson McQuilkin, missionary to Japan and former president of Columbia International University, had a plaque that hung on the wall of his home. It simply read, "The absent are safe here." Can you say that about your home? Can you say that about your office? Can you say that about your friendships? Can you say that when you're gabbing with a friend at the coffee shop or socializing at a party? The absent are safe here. We're all looking for safe people. Maybe you've been a part of a fellowship of friends who loved you and cherished you. You laughed together, you cried together. Sure, you experienced conflict on occasion. That's inevitable when you're in close community. But you never worried about your reputation because you knew your safe friends would protect you. They'd always give you the benefit of the doubt. They never talked about you behind your back. We all need safe friends. But are you a safe friend? Maybe this would be a good time to define what gossip is. Because many of us have too narrow a definition of gossip. To some, gossip is about deceit. It's about spreading rumors that are false. Rumors that are only half-truths or exaggerated truths. And that is a form of gossip, but that's not all gossip is. Over 30 years ago, I heard a definition of gossip from Melody Green that sticks with me to this day. She said, "Gossip is sharing anything about someone when the act of sharing it is not part of the solution to that person's problem." Do I need to read that again? Gossip is sharing anything about someone when the act of sharing it is not part of the solution to that person's problem. See, information shared with a friend over dinner may be both truth and gossip at the same time. Now, are there times when you need to go to someone else for advice on handling a problem? Absolutely. But beware. A lot of gossip goes disguised as counseling. And many of the people we go to for counseling are the wrong counselors. Check your motives. Are you looking for a solution or just a sympathetic ear? We make other excuses for gossip. We might attempt to Christianize gossip by cloaking it in the form of a prayer request. We might sugarcoat gossip with a layer of love to make it sound nice. In one breath, we say, "I think he works too much," or "I can't believe she feeds that to her kids." And then we exclaim, "But I love her. She's a sweetheart." Look, if you want to be a safe friend, here's a simple tip. When you're talking about someone else, pretend they're standing there with you. How much will that govern what you say? And if you're still not sure if you're gossiping, then use this rule. If in doubt, keep your lips zipped. Keep your trap shut for Christ and his kingdom. Well, the Bible warns us not just to avoid gossip, but to avoid the gossiper. Proverbs 20, verse 19 cautions us, "A gossip betrays a confidence. So avoid anyone who talks too much." This is sound counsel. But I actually, for the moment, I think we should look at it from the other way around. Think about it. If you're a gossiper, do you realize you are scaring away all the safe people? Do you realize that until you become safe, you will never develop close connection to wise, safe people because they know better than to let you in? Let's get safe and become safe. And remember, the warning against gossip does not just go for the gossiper, but also the gossipy. Proverbs 17:4, a wicked person listens to deceitful lips. A liar pays attention to a destructive tongue. A few moments ago, I referenced a passage by Paul in Romans 1, where he makes a list of sins that deeply disturb God. Well, Paul goes on to confront not just the sinner, but those who sit by and approve of the ones sinning. Ask yourself, how many times have you been guilty, not of spreading the rumor, but sitting idly by while it carries on around you? Could you find a way to nicely put a stop to it? Here's my point. Let's help each other. Can we do that? Let's help each other like Suzanne helped me. Okay, maybe some of us need more help than others. But we all need help. We all need help. And we can partner together to create a safe spiritual community. God is looking for someone in your family or your circle of friends who'll be brave enough to gently say something when the conversation veers into gossip. So say something. Of course, it can't be done with a high-handed, self-righteous, judgy disposition that calls people on the carpet. No, but what if we could create a community of God's people among whom correction could be given in humility and received in humility, knowing that none of us have our junk together? I guess what I'm saying is, friends don't let friends gossip. It's too destructive. Let me pull one more topic from the book of Proverbs that goes hand in hand with Paul's charge to change the way we talk to and talk about one another. See, the sages had something to say about criticism. Proverbs 11, verse 12. Whoever derides their neighbor has no sense, but the one who has understanding holds their tongue. Do you use your words to build up or tear down, to encourage or discourage, to admonish or demolish? What are you known for at work? What are you known? How are you known among your friends? Are you known as caustic? Are you known as a critic? Proverbs 12:18, reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. May I speak to our married couples for a moment? I've seen marriages devastated by criticism. Maybe you come home and you're infuriated by the ineptitude of your spouse. How can she be so disorganized? How can he be so unsuccessful? How can she be so lazy? Or you rationalize your words, saying, it's okay. She knows me. He knows I don't mean it. He doesn't take it personally. You minimize your actions as you twist the dagger. Maybe you hope to motivate your spouse by denigration. You criticize his performance, refusing to give your approval and acceptance until he fulfills your expectations. Look, I know it sounds like a good idea in the moment. It's not a good idea. It's not a good idea. Here's a scary thought for parents. Insecurity is a verbally transmitted disease. And overly critical comments we make to our kids spread it. Don't raise your hand. I wonder how many of you had a parent whose constant critique of your appearance, performance, and schoolwork gave you a complex. Now, I know parents aren't the source of every insecurity, but God help me not to hurt my girls. God help me not to ruin my relationship with my daughters by being quick to criticize. Let's return to a proverb I shared a few moments ago. Proverbs 18, verse 21. The tongue is the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Okay, we've spent the majority of this message talking about the devastating power of the tongue. But friends, if the tongue can wreak so much havoc, could it not also bring life? Proverbs 10 verse 21, the lips of the righteous nourish many, but fools die for lack of sense. Friends, I believe the tongue has the power to heal. The power to take someone who's broken and discouraged and lift them up with love and acceptance. Proverbs 16:24, gracious words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. My friends, imagine how different your life will look if your words were sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. So, let's put this into practice right away. Instead of picking people apart with our carpet and complaining, lift them up with your life-giving words of encouragement. And I'm going to challenge you to do it today. Before you leave this building, before you fall asleep tonight, do it today and do it tomorrow. Don't let a day go by without lifting up someone with your words. And friends, make it practical. Send that email. Jot a note. Make a phone call. And hear me, you can keep it simple. You don't need to write a book. You'd be surprised by the power of a brief, well-worded sentence. A friend stopped by my office yesterday while I was writing this message, simply to cheer me on and tell me my work was worth it. He was in my office less than 30 seconds, but the meaning behind his words lingered long after he left. Friends, everybody needs encouragement. So encourage your kids. Encourage your friends' kids. Encourage your kids' friends. Encourage your enemies. Encourage your frenemies. Encourage your coworker, your mail carrier, your flight attendant. Hey, and students, got some of you in the room. This applies to you too. I don't know if you know this, but most of your peers are wrestling with insecurity every day. And most days they're getting whooped. Now, us adults in the room, we've got insecurity nailed. We don't have anything to worry about like you do. But you're surrounded every day by students who are deeply insecure. Why not use your words to encourage them? No, don't flatter them. If flattery is us giving to get, flattery means we have ulterior motives. Don't encourage people so you can be liked. Encourage people so they can feel loved. Use your words to build people up, not chew people up. Oh, imagine a church full of people who go out of their way to encourage one another. Imagine a group of Christ followers who breathe life into each other with their words. Show me that kind of church, and I'll show you a church that's running out of seats. Pray with me. Lord, Lord, in this moment, I think maybe the best place to start is by asking your forgiveness. Because a lot of us have used a lot of words to hurt a lot of people. And we call upon your grace to forgive us, to show us your mercy. Thank you for getting our attention. We don't want to be a part of the problem. We don't want to perpetuate the sin and shame, the evil that seems to keep this world spinning around and round and round and round. Nope. We want to go against the grain. And we want to be people with life-giving words. Me included. So we ask you for the grace to forgive us. Oh, but we need your grace to shape us, to mold us, to form us into the people you've called us to be. We need that desperately. Lord, help us to do the impossible. Help us to tame the tongue. Give us a vision for the way you want us to speak. Give us faith to pray that practical but powerful prayer from Psalm 141 so that you can shape us into the people you've called us to be and help us live the kind of life we're called to live. Abundant life in you. Lord, I pray for my friends who are here today who have been hurt really badly by the words of others. I know this message might have stirred up some of those feelings in them. Well, I pray you meet them right where they are. At home, watching online, listening to this in a car, sitting right here in a seat in front of me. Meet them right there. May they sense your presence. And may they hear your whisper saying, I love you fiercely. I pray also for my friends who have received these kinds of words from people in church. May they find healing too. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us here at Capital to create a safe place for people to journey, to grow. Yes, to receive feedback. Yes, to hear truth. But may it always be held tightly with grace, because that's love. We pray this in the name of our King. Amen. Okay, let me give you some homework. Here are four assignments. Here's the first one. Ask God to watch your mouth. Now, I thought about wording this, watch your mouth. And there's truth in that, because we have a role to play. And it's a little bit theologically obtuse for me to say ask God to watch your mouth, because God watches your mouth. Not in a way that he's ready with a lightning bolt, but he knows what you're going to say before you say it, okay? What am I actually praying with that verbiage? What I'm praying is that you'd go to him and say, God, I need your help. I need your help to watch my mouth. Open my eyes to see these patterns of communication. Ask him. Ask him to see what's been coming out of you. Second, ask God to heal your heart. See, once you see what's coming out of you, you got to see what's in you. And that's where he comes into play very, very importantly. Ask him to heal whatever that is, to give you a love for people, a kind of love that he has for people, okay? Third assignment, ask a friend to forgive you. Maybe someone you love has been wounded by your words, even in the last week. Friend, that may be the most important text you send. That may be the most important call you make. Ask a friend to forgive you. And finally, ask a friend to hold you accountable. Speaking from personal experience here, it's a gift. It's a gift. Ask someone close to you to help you watch your mouth. Stand with me. These messages are a little weighty, aren't they, these days? I wish I could tell you it's going to get any better next week. It's not! But we'll approach that topic with the grace of King Jesus as well. Here's a verse for the week. Luke 6, verse 45. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. The image on the screen and this graphic that follows are available for you to download from our website and our social media accounts, so be watching for them. Friends, as always, if you'd like to receive prayer, if you're here in the building, you're welcome to come to the front and ask someone to pray for you. We'll have some people here at the front to do just that. If you're watching online or throughout the week, if you have a need, send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, because we want to pray for you. Here's what I want to pray for all of you. May the Lord station a guard over the gate of your mouth as he transforms your heart, so that the words which escape your lips may be sweeter than a tic-tac. Thanks for coming. Grace and peace.